Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, my guest is one of the nation's leading authorities on healthcare economics, Dr. Uwe Reinhardt of Princeton University. He's been a member of the Institute of Medicine and the National Academies of Science since 1978. He's a past president of the Association of Health Services Research. He's a member of numerous editorial boards, of which we should mention the Journal of Health Economics, the Milbank Memorial Quarterly, Health Affairs, the New England Journal of Medicine, and the Journal of the American Medical Association. We're going to be discussing healthcare reform, the reasons it might be needed, the suggested reforms, and barriers to change. You can reach us with your questions and comments. Here in Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org, and we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Dr. Reinhardt, it's a real pleasure to have you join us again. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Dr. Woodward. It's a pleasure. I remember last time when we chatted.
It's just enjoyable to get a chance to talk with someone who's so aware of what the problems are. So let's just jump in there and start. Do we need some health reform in this country? And if so, why might we need it?
We certainly did. We had been talking about three problems. One is access, particularly for something roughly 15% of the population who doesn't have any health insurance. They'll get health care when they're critically needed, but they often go broke, they postpone health care, and just get rationed. Let's be call a spade here. And then, in addition, we do have a quality problem that, in the sense that at its best, this health system is fantastic, but there are some real issues with quality that were highlighted in two books by the Institute of Medicine. And then the third issue is the costs of healthcare in this country are roughly double what they are in any other industrialized country. It is breaking the government's budget. It is breaking the budgets of households. And at some point, we do have to address costs. So there has to be health reform. This bill that President Obama signed is a patch on an existing system, and he has said, look, this solves the problem of the uninsured. It really doesn't 100%. We need, in the future, continued health reform.
You know, we continue to hear arguments against change, it seems to me, although when I hear arguments, they're really against the changes that are being suggested. I've not heard much about other ways to do things. So it's more against a change from the, you know, and continuing the status quo. And then when I hear that, my first thought is, isn't the evidence plentiful, as you just described, that it's bankrupting our country, it's not equitable, and it's so too variable in quality? It what we're doing just doesn't work. So I don't understand the difficulties in moving towards change.
Well, there are two reasons. So the one is my friend Stu Altman once in despair said, you know, it's interesting, whenever we talk about health reform, every interest group comes with its proposal to the table. And if it can't get that, the second best is the status quo. Why? A, they know it, and B, there is the fear that if anything changes, they may get less money. And that is what rivets us into the status quo, that everyone's second best solution is the status quo, and the first best solution they come up with is guaranteed to be one that gives them more money. And then the other part of the equation is, unlike, say, Germans or Canadians, we don't have a consensus on the very simple question, to what extent should I be my brother's and sister's keeper in health care if they are poor? We don't have a consensus on that in this country. And in other, when you listen to Fox Channel News or MSNBC, you get vastly different answers to this question. And lacking this consensus, almost anyone, when health reform is out there, will scream it's horrible. If this, the Republicans are basically saying it's the end of the world. But if should they win the White House and the Hill and came up with a plan, you can count on a Democrat saying, you know, this is going to kill babies. I mean, it's just how it's always been. Mm-hmm. And maybe it could well be we have so much else. Maybe God has said, you know something, health reform you'll never get.
Mm-hmm. What, since we've identified access, quality, and cost, and that's certainly the what we hear over and over again, let's talk about some of these a little bit individually. What are the principal drivers of cost again? I know last time you were on, I'm sure we discussed this, but let's listen to this again. Where are the costs coming from?
Well, when you talk about cost, there's always the two things. What drives the annual increases in health spending? And the second is, what factors determine the level, the fact that we're at any point in time twice as expensive as Canada or Germany or the Netherlands, right? Those are two separate questions. If you look at the level, I believe the bulk of it can be explained not by utilizations. Americans are not heavy users of healthcare, less than Germans, less than the Dutch, less than the Swiss. Our prices for absolutely anything you can dream up of will be double or three times as much as what a Canadian pays. See, I know, for example, a stent, you know, for artery blockage in Germany, for the very same American-made stent, the Germans will pay less than half what we Americans pay. Lipitor, coronary bypass. Having a baby in America costs 3 to 4 times as much as what it costs to have a baby in Germany. I mean, you can come and say, well, our babies are better. And I say, well, maybe. But 4 times is good. So this has to be the major driver. And we wrote a paper some years ago saying it's the price is stupid. So that's the level. When you look at what drives the annual increase in health spending, on that score, we are actually not worse than many European systems. If you plot annual percentage growth in health spending, the European system, Japan and others, in some periods, grow faster than we do. The problem is we do it at double the level mm-hmm. each time, mm-hmm. and that's what's killing the breaking the bank.
So why then are the prices so much greater? And I'm going to maybe throw out a possible answer. I mean, people say, well, the free market should determine that. And as I understand it, that may be true, but you can't figure out what the prices are. I mean, you can't go out there and find out what it's going to cost you to do because of this multiple systems of payments that are there. So it's very difficult to imagine that the free market's going to control these prices. But anyway, I'm not trying to answer my own question. I just want to make a comment that it just seems ridiculous when we can't find prices of things, at least in the hospital.
I just come from a big shopping center. I was looking for a suitcase, right? And I went from Macy's to Lord & Taylor's and others. And they had the same model, and they had slightly different prices for those. But you could bet if I want a given model, I go to the price that's the lowest, right? You and I would do this. But now imagine this. They blindfold you, and they shove you into Macy's or the shopping center. You don't even know what shop you're in. And you sort of grope around for suitcases, right? And you come out with something. And they say, shop efficiently for cost-effective suitcases. So I go in there, but I'm blindfolded, and finally I come out with something. I didn't know the price because I was blindfolded. I didn't even know what color this damn thing was. In fact, I know very little about it, and I come out. That is how every American shops for healthcare. We called my wife and I. I said, let's pretend we're immigrants, we're not poor, we're uninsured. She asked, what does a normal delivery cost of the Princeton Hospital? No answer. They wouldn't give it to her. So I'll try it with colonoscopy. They wouldn't give it to me. I mean, just imagine that. And so the people who said we should have a free market in healthcare, I would say, well, before you even dream of that, tell us something about prices and the quality of the care of individual doctors and hospitals. To shove people blindfolded into a market and say, shop around because markets work, is just plain good all-American bullshine. It just cannot work.
All right. Are there other reasons why our prices are so much greater than everybody else's?
Yeah, the second reason is this. In all countries that I mentioned, Switzerland, Germany, etc., the demand side is fairly powerful. Like in Switzerland, per county, all the insurers form an association, sit at one side of the table, and all the physicians are in a physician association at the other side of the table. They hash out a joint fee schedule that then everyone pays the same fee for the same procedure, and the county government tells them, if you guys break the bank, in other words, if annual health spending rises because of what you negotiated by 3%, we're going to veto it. And if you can't agree, we'll have an arbitrator tell you what the fees will be. In the U.S., we have 2,500 insurance companies, some big ones and some small ones. But in any local market, even the big ones like WellPoint and Aetna are small. And vis-a-vis the huge hospital complexes, often a hospital is the only one in town, or they are so consolidated, like in California, that they will dictate prices to you. So I wrote a paper published in England called Divide et Impera, that's Roman for divide and rule. The supply side of healthcare in America has divided the payers so that each of them is weak. And that is why they can dictate the prices. Now, when you then say, oh, we have the best health system in the world, I say mazel tov. Then enjoy it and don't whine to me about how much healthcare costs. You almost guaranteed it the way you structure this health system.
To change horses a little bit, unless you want to stay on this, I want to get to the other issue that it's really all countries are having an increase in the amount of healthcare per capita spending that is going to healthcare. And I read one place, maybe the exception is Canada. First off, is that true? And then if it is, what are the rest of the world going to have to do about this issue?
Well, a main driver that research suggests is the ever new technology that comes on board, which in many instances, particularly in biologicals, these are these not chemically based but biologically based drugs. They could cost $100,000 a year,
right.
These drugs.
Right.
They are life-saving in the sense that sometimes they prolong life, say, maybe by a few months, half a year. And as a nation, we basically have said we don't want to really ration end-of-life care. In particular, the Congress is just very fanatic about it. If you mention it, they'll put a mustache on you and call you a Nazi. So that's one issue. The other issue is that as a nation, we are extremely risk-averse. We don't want to have any risk. And therefore, physicians very often do tests or imaging that really, clinically, a good doctor wouldn't need. In England, doctors do a lot of diagnosing with their hands. Here we image. And then you have $1,000 a pop. In Japan, an MRI costs $200. Here we pay often over $1,000 for that. So that adds money. Some people say our tort system, the fact that you can get sued, is not the malpractice premium. That's only 1% of health spending or so. It is the defensive medicine that when a doctor looks at you, they always look at a potential litigant and say, well, you know, I think I know what's going on here. I don't actually need this test. But if I'm wrong, which could happen, and I didn't do the test, I'll be in court and with a malpractice suit. So they say, what the heck, I'll do the test. And so some people claim an extra 10% of health spending can be just attributed to our malpractice system. We don't really know because it's very hard to research. What I really would need to do is take a random sample of 4,000 doctors. Half of them, I say, whatever you guys do, we won't sue you. and the other half will say, you're living in America and you can get sued for anything. And then see whether they develop different practice styles. And you'd have to observe them for a decade or so. Mm-hmm. Then you would know. Mm-hmm. But we don't have that experiment.
Right.
I wish we had done it.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection, and my guest today is Dr. Uwe Reinhardt. He's a health care economist at Princeton University. We're talking about suggested health care reforms, why it's needed, and perhaps some barriers to change. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. My understanding also is that we've got another big driver of costs, at least in this country as compared to others, is that 2,500 different insurance companies have a lot of administrative costs.
Oh, I do apologize for forgetting that. The administrative overhead of our system is found in no other country. Taiwan has a single-payer system. They officially pay 2% of total health spending on health care. It's probably a little more if you counted it right, but it's about that. And Medicare, by the way, similarly doesn't spend nearly as much as a private insurer. Now, with private insurance, if you have small insurers with 100, 200,000 insured lives, your overhead for a dollar premium, say, 45% goes for marketing, administration, and profits, 45 cents of every dollar. And these people have the lack of shame to actually put that in a letter that's on the web that I can give you. Mm-hmm. It's called the Council for Affordable Health Insurance. It's a joke, in mm-hmm. my view. Mm-hmm. But you look, you Googled that, and they were complaining that the regulation in the Affordable Care Act that's saying you have to pay out at least 80% of your premium for health care, that they couldn't live by that. They say they couldn't even live with 70 pennies of a dollar. So they said they need something around 55 to 60 was the most they could pay for health care. Mm-hmm. Now, I always say, if you guys were with a bunch of insurance executives from other country, wouldn't you blush admitting that? That you have to burn almost half the premium on non-health care. But that's what the fact is. For larger insurers, really large ones, you might, they could 80, 85% they pay out. And that's what's in the law now. And, you know, they can do that. Still, that is one heck of a lot more than Canada, say, is paying out of pocket, or Germany or Switzerland. So that overhead that doesn't go to doctors, doesn't go to hospitals, is in this country twice as big as it should be mm-hmm. in an efficient system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my shooting off the hip.
Right, and your comment is that also in the Medicare system, the overhead is much, much less than that. So really not the U.S. system, it's the private sector is where that overhead is so much.
It's not an ideology, it's just a fact.
Yep.
Medicare has one nomenclature. It's the same throughout the whole country. Billing is electronic. And I served on a hospital board, and we said Medicare pays within 20 days. Private insurers often 60, sometimes 90 days. Now, some of them are down to 60, but still, there is, and I tell, I'm not against private insurance. I'm just saying to them, when I speak to them, to say, you owe it to the American people to get a common nomenclature so you could have one style of bill and bill electronically, and you should pay the doctor within 20 days. You know, I mean, it's not too much to ask, and they have never felt the pressure to do that.
Let's also get back to the word you used earlier that you were hesitant to use, and that's rationing. And I'm going to throw out something you've written earlier. You got to be careful when you write as much as you do, but I think
yeah, sure.
I think you'll you're not going to be unhappy with me. It says, quote, "For reasons that escape me, many Americans do not regard rationing scarce resources through the marketplace by price and ability to pay as rationing at all, reserving the term for government withholding of marginally beneficial procedures based on formal cost-effectiveness analysis." What are you saying there again?
Well, I mean, to me, that is really a mental flaw when you think that way. Mm-hmm. When we teach freshman economics, you can look in several books. We say, what is the role of prices in an economy? And we say the role of prices is to ration scarce resources. We use the word ration there. And my colleague, he's actually a very card-carrying Republican, wrote in his textbook, Harvey Rosen, in his textbook to say, we have only so much bread and more demand for bread than we have, certainly if you go around the world. And the way we deal with this is, if you have the money, you get bread, and if you don't, you don't. That is rationing. And the kind of rationing when government does it, I was taught at Yale by Professor Tobin, Nobel laureate. We call that non-price rationing. They say you can either ration by price and ability to pay, or you can ration by some government mechanism. And it depends how much you care about fairness. If you care about fairness, rationing through the market typically means the poor get less and the rich get more. And if you're happy with that, fine. And we don't mind that with clothes, with shoes, with entertainment, or with wines. We don't mind that at all, that the poor get, you know, cheap wine, if any, and the rich drink these fancy wines. We don't care about that. Health care is different. We do care about that. And education is that way, too. And at least in theory, we care about the administration of justice should be also independent of income, although you and I know that that's just a dream. That's not the reality.
And so what we have in this system at this time is that we do ration health care, and it's by access due to cost. There's people who just can't, an increasing number until recently, have been denied access because of cost.
Well, you see, survey after survey that are done by the Commonwealth Fund and others, when they ask people what have been sort of your main problems in healthcare last year, you know, not getting healthcare because it costs too much. The Americans, we always win on that one. More Americans say that than any other nation, and it stands to reason. But think, for example, you now hear about consumer-driven healthcare. And they say people should have skin in the game. So you should have a high deductible, say maybe $5,000, and then a cost sharing. And then your maximum out-of-pocket per year for family should be, say, $8,000 to $10,000, right? Okay, if you had that set up, now the median income, money income, in 2010 was $50,000, which means there has to be a lot of families making $30,000 to $40,000, or even less. And if you were to tell them your maximum out-of-pocket for healthcare is $10,000, you may be talking about a quarter of their income. Those people will tighten the belt. They will think twice before going to the doctor and pay that out-of-pocket because it's in the deductible. Well, if you take two young professionals living in Washington, together they make $300,000. I cannot imagine that they ever say, well, our kid has a chest ache, but Jesus, you know, we have this deductible. Let's just wait and see what happens. We're not going to the doctor. Those professionals will take that kid to the doctor. Mm-hmm. So anyone who would tell me that consumer-driven healthcare doesn't ration healthcare to some extent by income, I would sell them some oceanfront property in Iowa, because if they believe that, they would buy that property.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that over the last several years that deductibles have increased, we're losing maternity benefits. I mean, things are getting sliced back. Why haven't people reacted more at the polling place, or are they, and I'm misunderstanding how they're voting?
Well, I mean, you can be ignorant means not well informed. Ignorant is different from stupid. I just mean you don't have information. Or you can be systematically misinformed that you think you have information, but it's wrong.
Right.
And in this country, we are spending billions upon billions of dollars in the campaign. I think we'll probably come close to $1 trillion to elect this president. It wouldn't surprise me when we're done. And most of that money was designed to misinform the voter who is trying to earn a living and doesn't have the time, say, as I have, to read all about health reform. They're going to take it from what they hear on TV. And that information is systematically a lie. So, every politician knows that the way to win elections in America is to lie to the people. And when you have a democracy that runs on that system, and when the journalists very often don't ask penetrating questions or they give an answer, I've heard it during the debate that a presidential candidate comes out with a complete falsehood, and yet these journalists don't have the guts either or the knowledge to have a follow-up and say, wait a minute, what you just said isn't true, right? Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard that?
Sure.
Because they don't have the depth.
Right.
You know, it would be much better to have a segment, say, let's have a segment on foreign policy now and bring in some experts from both ends of the political spectrum, but at least people who know the facts, rather than a journalist, I can forgive them, who can be snowed. And the journalist can get snowed just as easily. I've heard incredible stuff said on TV where you just pull your hair out and say, how could you, the journalist, not know this? For example, that the elderly under Medicare don't have choice of provider. That's just a falsehood, and everyone who knows health care knows that. Mm-hmm. And yet the journalist sat there and didn't say a word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess I don't want to harp on the journalist thing, but there's more and more urgency to get information out so that there's less time spent and due diligence, and now we have less and less people who are really specializing in certain areas because of the rapid change with it going to the internet and so forth. It seems like all those are forces working against a better understanding of reality out there.
I mean, journalists. I remember this in a totally different sphere. A friend who is an executive at Lou Harris Polls, he said, even after George W. himself had said on TV that the Iraqis didn't fly these planes into the World Trade Center, 43% of Americans believed those pilots were Iraqis. Mm-hmm. Now, who put that into their head? Mm-hmm. It's these websites that they look up. Mm-hmm. And then the sad part is, see, for example, I will watch television channels whose commentators have ideology different from mine. But I watch it to see what do they say, what do they know, etc. But most people switch into the channel. So if you're a conservative, all you watch is Fox News. If you're a Democrat, all you watch is MSNBC. And neither of them will tell you the truth.
All right. Dr. Reinhart, we need to take a short break. Let me remind listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, our local number 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue to discuss health care reform with Dr. Uwe Reinhart of Princeton University. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is Dr. Uwe Reinhardt. He's a healthcare economist at Princeton University. We're discussing healthcare reform, the reasons it's needed, suggested reforms, and barriers to change. If you've got questions or comments, we've got about another 25 or 27 minutes with which we can answer your questions. You can send them to lineone@alaskapublic.org. You can give us a call at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. I also wanted to direct people to alaskapublic.org and our Line One website so that you can see some of the information we have there to supplement this program. In particular, there's a short video that is helpful in understanding our current healthcare situation and some of the suggestions for improvement that's put out at the Kaiser educational system. The Kaiser Foundation has a wonderful bit of information, and one's a short little cartoon about this. And then there's some other links to both some comments that Dr. Reinhardt has been making, and as well as some more information about healthcare at the Henry Kaiser Family Foundation. So those are all can be found at our on our website. Also, as a reminder, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday night, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be able to answer your calls or your questions at that time. So let me move on to another suggestion of what we should be doing. There's been a couple of comments or major suggestions about a single-payer system, and I'm going to, again, take the initiative and read something. This is written by Arnold Relman. Arnold Relman's rather well-known in the medical field. He was the editor-in-chief for a number of years for the New England Journal of Medicine. And he has recently written an article really suggesting that we need to make some changes in our healthcare system. And this is from his article in the British Medical Journal. And he quote, "We will have to replace all our insurance systems, public and private, with a single public plan that guarantees universal access to prepaid comprehensive care. And this plan should be funded by a progressive health care tax that all citizens, including government officials, must pay according to their means. To provide this kind of prepaid comprehensive care, we need a reorganized medical care system based on private, nonprofit, medical specialty groups in which physicians are paid largely by salary." And he goes on to say, "In my view, by far the most important explanation of why we need this change and the primary care of our unique problems is that the U.S. alone, among all advanced Western countries, has allowed the healthcare system to become a market and its physicians behave as if they're in a business." Your comments on suggestions like this?
Well, the idea of a single payer has been around as an organization, Physician for a National Health Plan. It used to be in the 70s, the unions, Kennedy, were for that. And of course, recently there was a survey of the most popular insurance product in the U.S., and it happens to be Medicare, which is a single payer system. So the idea is not new. The trouble is, politically, I think, so at this stage yet, Americans aren't ready to embrace that idea. The fear is this, that the government, once it controls all of health spending, will put on the screws and drive the system down to the point that less money is spent on the system than the populace would want spent if they had more of a say. And of course, in our democracy, the people have less and less say, and the moneyed interest groups basically run the show. So the people are worried that this would happen. And when you look at systems, say, like Canada or Taiwan, who have these, there always is this struggle with funding. The idea that at some point the system will say, well, we're not going to cover this procedure, because per dollar spent, it just doesn't make sense. In this, people don't want that. They call it rationing. What they don't realize, of course, is, as we said earlier, we do ration. Take biological drugs. Very often the private insurer says, you have to pay 30% or 35% coinsurance for this drug. What that then means is for a $100,000 drug per year, you're supposed to pay $35,000 out of pocket. If you don't have it, then you either don't get the drug, or the drug company, if you can find a company to do it, will give you the drug for free. But it's a struggle. And so we're actually doing this kind of rationing, but here we do it mainly by money and price. And everyone who has good insurance thinks, well, that doesn't affect me, so I don't want a single-payer system. So we had referendums on it twice in California, and the voters voted it down. And so I think it's worth keeping alive as an idea. This is an option. Mm-hmm. But you have to ultimately worry, will you get the votes for it? And so far, no.
Mm-hmm. But we have some callers, and I want to get to them. But I also want to focus on this single payer just a little longer. There are definitely advantages and disadvantages. And you've talked about some of the disadvantages, is that the political system will be so much of the influence of the wealthy, or those with the campaign contributions and so forth. What are some advantages, however, of the single payer system?
Oh, I just wrote an article in the New York Times. It's on a blog post, New York Times Economics with an X, and you find it there. Humbled Again, well, actually, I entitled it Humbled Again in Taiwan, but the editors gave it a different title, Some Progress of Healthcare in Taiwan. And I was there 2 weeks ago, and this doctor in charge of IT, health information system, gets up, and he makes a presentation that just knocked me out of my chair. And I went up and asked him, tell me this, were you just dreaming? Is that what you guys are dreaming of doing, or you're actually doing this? He said, no, we're doing this. And so he, for example, you go into a hospital in Taiwan, and there is a kiosk. You put in your smart card, and you get your medical records with all the tests you had, with outcomes and explanations what they mean, all the imaging you had, a complete medical record. You see, you can make with that, through the kiosk, an appointment with your doctor. They tell you when he's available, you pick the date, and you have an appointment. I don't think anywhere in America is there a hospital where you can do that. The only one where you might, probably can, is Kaiser on the West Coast, Kaiser Permanente. They have such a data system. And the Veterans Administration. Now, the Veterans Administration is a curious thing. Americans say they hate socialized medicine, but the purest form of socialized medicine is the Veterans Administration health system, which is acknowledged to have one of the most advanced healthcare information systems. So I think a government-run system like Taiwan or the VA is much easier to have a really state-of-the-art 21st century health information system. In that loose, fragmented system we have, we won't get that for decades. Not for decades. And that's a great disadvantage. Secondly, if you have best clinical practices, a single-payer system can very quickly diffuse them among physicians and decide, we're not going to pay for this old-fashioned thing anymore. You're going to have to use this procedure if you want to get paid. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, a downside is when a single-payer system makes a boo-boo, for example, sets the price of a procedure too low so that doctors can't cover costs, that diffuses fast through the system too. So they all have advantages and disadvantages. I think on balance, what single payer gives you is very good health care for half price.
And it doesn't have the administrative overhead we talked about that we're suffering with in the United States. Is that
That's one reason the costs are lower. And the other one is that you negotiate prices and you don't have the supply side dictate them. In California, Sutter Health is a huge hospital system. No one can really negotiate with these guys because these guys they can pretty much dictate. That's what we need, and if you don't like it, we won't accept your patients, and then an insurance company cannot sell if Sutter isn't in it. So that's a very lopsided market. You wouldn't have that. Single payer, there's a powerful payer on the other side of the table.
Mike, if you're still there, thanks for waiting. You have a question?
Yeah, this is Michael Carey. I'm a journalist here in town. I guess I'm one of the reporters who's screwing up. I wanted to ask, there's so many questions here, but one of them is, Robert Reich was here recently, and he talked about the growing pace of medical expenses and the medical part of federal spending, and we have to do something.
Right.
What is a rational, fair way of analyzing how fast it's growing, and what is possible within the kind of, I mean, quickly possible or fairly quickly possible within the political constraints that you're describing, which seem to be nobody wants to make any changes because they don't want to make any sacrifices.
Right. So I just gave a talk in Washington on this very topic. This was actually to staffers from the National Governors Association, medical directors, people like that. And I said, well, the way I see it, we're sort of at a crossroads. One road I call Pac-Man Road. It's Pac-Man Road, and I said, this thing is chewing up our government budgets, chewing up our take-home pay for workers, chewing up businesses, you name it. That's Pac-Man Road. We're on that road now. And I said, I just can't see another decade on that road. And it's chewing up education in the state budgets, and that's very alarming. The other road, you can then go left or right. If you went left, you would say, well, why don't we copy what the Swiss do? The Swiss are not known to be communists. They are freedom-loving people. But at some point, they do, as I said, negotiate prices and somehow have market power on the payment side of healthcare. The Swiss have a very fine health system. So that's what I call an all-payer system, where every insurer in a state pays the same fee to the same for a procedure, regardless of which that hospital is. For a normal delivery, this is the money. And then you tell the hospitals, here's your money, set your operations to somehow break even. Work back from a budget like any other business. That's one way. That would be copying the Europeans. The other way is to ration healthcare by income class. Say we have a three-tier system. And here's how that would look. For publicly insured people, Medicaid and the military people, and for we would make Medicare into a poverty program, and you know, well-to-do elderly would be given a voucher and they'd be out of it. For those people, we would have public hospitals, public neighborhood clinics. Everything would be sort of budgeted, right? Like a government-run, like England, little national health service for the lower-income people. Then for the middle class, we would have rationing by price through what is called reference pricing. So somebody is insured at General Motors, and the employer, through their insurance, would say, you want to have a baby, here are some low-cost hospitals in your region. If you go there, we'll pay 80% of your bill. If you want a more expensive hospital, we'll pay all the difference between that low-cost hospital and that expensive one. You have to pay out of your own pocket. What that would mean over time, even with private employer-based insurance, the janitors and the low-paid secretaries, they would gravitate to low-cost doctors, low-cost hospitals, and generics, and the executives and engineers, the highly paid people, they would go to the more expensive, luxurious hospitals, have brand-name drugs, etc. So you would ration there. And then for the rich, who sort of the one percenters, or I would say actually five percenters, you would have boutique medicine. Anything your fancy that strikes your fancy, you can have, but you pay for it. And I think that would be the system. Now, if I had to bet which way we're going to go, it's that second one, rationing by income class. Mm-hmm. And the American people will vote for it. Why? People will tell them this is the best system in the world, so they'll vote for it and bitch about it. You know?
Are we going to eventually have a single-payer system?
I think it could be at some point that the middle class realizes, you know, this is a losing battle for us. We're working hard. We're not getting ahead. We're driven into these less attractive hospitals. And, of course, people then always think they get worse care. May not be true, but they think it.
Right.
And some political entrepreneur will come along and say, you know, you guys, you've been had, and you have to bestir yourself. It could be that unions come back. One should not, sort of in history, the pendulum swings back and forth. It could very well be, but I would say probably not in this decade. But people are bestirring themselves. You know, in Israel, the poor are beginning to really get rambunctious, and they say it's a bunch of plutocrats who own Israel. I heard that on NPR today. It's happening in many parts of Europe, and it could happen here, but I just can't see it for the next two rounds of the presidential election.
Okay, thank you.
We can still make it with misinformation.
All right, yeah. Mark, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I think part of the question was answered just now for future options for healthcare systems. A while ago, I'm on Medicare, and I have good, state-run or state-provided medical insurance as well as a secondary. But I went, called the doctor's office to have a procedure. They said we can get you in like in 10 days or something like that, and that was fine with me. They asked me about my insurance. I said I was Medicare, and they said, oh, wait a minute, you couldn't get in for 3 months because the doctor doesn't like to take Medicare patients. Now, I offered to pay to see the doctor, and they declined. They said that that was illegal, and I don't understand that. I wonder whether that question can be answered or whether I was just misinformed.
No, you're exactly right. We have a particular situation up here where Medicare is paced a little. Now, just the opposite, just for Dr. Reinhart before he answers, our Medicaid payment is very good relative to the rest of the country. But Dr. Reinhart, you want to try to answer Mark's question?
Yeah, well, it is true that it is illegal. Doctors can extra bill only up to 15%, and then they have to give the patients reasons why. But you cannot just pay the doctor on top of it. And the reason why that legislation was written that way is actually kind of simple. Because if the government were to say, look, supposing you didn't have any insurance and patients just paid out of pocket, then doctors would sort of ration by price, right? And if they knew somebody has a little money, they would charge them a higher price, and if they were poor, a lower price. Now, if the government then says, well, we pay this and that fee on top of it, all that would then do is raise the total income doctors get. And one way I explain it to my students, say, imagine in New York, to make sure the poor have housing, the government says we'll give every family $1,000 a month for rental. Rich and poor, we give everyone $1,000. And I ask the students, what do you think would happen? But landlords can charge on top anything they want, let the free market rule. And I ask the students, what do you think would happen to rentals? You know, rentals would go up, maybe not exactly by $1,000, maybe some additional units would be built. But overall, all that would do is just push up prices. And that would be self-defeating. The taxpayer is paying like crazy. And then physicians extract from patients anything they can anyhow. Then I would just as soon tell physicians, you know what? You want to extract money, you do it, but you won't get any tax money. And so I would tell these physicians, if you don't take Medicare patients, you can't have ever any Medicare patients. You know, you just... You make up your mind. You either take Medicare patients or you don't. If you don't want to take them, fine. You're free country. You can do what you want. But you can't do business with us, Medicare, at all, for any patient. That would be my solution.
I see. Well, thank you for the explanation.
Right. Okay.
Thanks for your call, Mark. We have an email that asks a question that it comes up a lot also. Dr. Reinhardt, he says, should we charge more or can we charge more for those individuals who seem to be bringing their own health care risks to bear, those who might smoke or not do what they can for exercise or weight control? Is that an ethical issue? Is that appropriate? How would you address that problem?
I have to admit, when I sit at airports and sometimes see people stuffing themselves, and I'm sort of hemming and hawing, you know, I yearn for a certain type of French fries, and here's the outlet. And I say, nah, it's not good for you. And I don't. And then think that I'm going to have to pay for the face stuffers. It does occasionally occur to me, I would like to have a system that charges them more. And they do cost more. Obese people cost an employer a lot more than non-obese. The data on that are very clear. The problem with smoking, it's easy, and we've done it. We don't do it at the point that a physician says, hey, you're a smoker, I'll charge you twice as much, because doctors aren't ethically programmed to do this kind of stuff. But you do it through the insurance. If you buy health insurance and you're a smoker, you pay a much higher premium. The trouble of doing that with, say, obesity is that obesity has a genetic component. It's not just how you behave, although there is a strong behavioral component, but also, you know, some people can eat and eat and they don't get fat, and others try to diet and yet they get fat. So what you would very quickly get, in my view, is a lobby of these people and powerful trial lawyers that would nail the doctors and hospitals who would try to act on this. So I think no employer so far has had the guts to tackle that, because I think they fear the plaintiff's bar that would come in, mm-hmm. simply because it would soon be, you know, you're discriminatory to people who for some odd reason are programmed by nature to put on weight. That's mm-hmm. why we right. don't do it. Right. If it were easy, we would.
Right. We've got about 5 minutes, and I'd like you to make some comments about what looks like it's coming down the road with bundling of health care payments.
Right.
Maybe describe that and your feeling as to whether or not this is going to be an effective way to help control our increasing costs.
Bundled payments would basically mean that you get a bunch of experts together and say, for this condition, what does the evidence say would be the best medical treatment, the best bundle of services, you know, tests, operations, post and recovery care, et cetera, the bundle of services, and then we say, we'll pay a group called Accountable Care Organization the bundled fee, and then you tell the group, you decide how to spend this money, whether you want to spend it on primary care, on specialty care, on drugs, brand name, generic, whether you do want MRIs or not. You doctors know what to do, and if you are economically managing the care, the profit is yours. We have, of course, done this, and people shouldn't be so shocked. DRGs, diagnostic-related group payments for hospital, since 1983, when Ronald Reagan introduced them, hospitals have been paid bundled payments for hospital care for Medicare. And the prediction was, patients will die, doctors will cheat, hospitals will cheat, and they didn't. This thing works and has been copied around the world. Doing it for doctors, what it does, it makes doctors subcontractors to the hospital or whoever gets the bundled payment. And naturally, freedom-loving doctors are very hesitant to say, all of a sudden, I'm getting my paycheck from someone who gets that bundled payment. I don't like that. That's one. Secondly, remember the, mercifully, I forget her name, former Lieutenant Governor of New York, Betsy McCoy, when she sort of invented that counseling patients on living wills actually is death panels. And Sarah Palin from your state picked that up. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, everyone who proposed that was somehow a Nazi. You could easily do that with bundled payment, saying, guess what? They're paying your doctor in a way so that the less he does or she, the more money they make. Can you imagine how easy it is to demagogue a great idea?
Right.
And that's what I think, unfortunately, I mean, to me, to accuse the president of the United States to be a sort of latter-day Adolf Hitler is so offensive, and yet your former governor did just that. And I think it's, to me, a real problem to do health reform. I've been called on a website a notorious Nazi because of advocating cost-effectiveness analysis. This isn't the way citizens should talk to each other.
I just wrote down the, was it Pogo or something? The enemy is us. I mean, it's like we just, we've got our own problem here, and we're just not willing to address it for a number of reasons, misinformation and so forth. Well,
But our children, the students I teach, I tell them, you will have to, whether you like it or not. You've got to be more civilized than your parents.
Right. Dr. Reinhart, it is really, really a pleasure to have you take the time with us and help us understand what's going on. And hopefully we'll figure out a way to solve this problem for everyone's benefit. We really appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you very much. There's always that hope, isn't there?
All right. Have a good day.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. If anyone would like to continue today's conversation, you can join us on KSKA on via Facebook, and you can find these links at our website, alaskapublic.org. Also, you might want to take the time next week as we revisit. This will be the first time we visit the issue of medical ethics, of which I guess we could look at a number of things we talked today. On the afternoon of August 6th, our guest will be Dr. Daniel P. Somasi. He is a MD, PhD, professor of medicine and ethics at the University of Chicago. We're going to be discussing issues like end-of-life care, national immunization policies, the use of embryonic stem cells, which all have some very ethical considerations and how this might be addressed. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, July 3rd. Actually, it's August 6th from 2 to 3 p.m. Remember, we repeat the same evening each Monday at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1 KSKA. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and also our audio engineer today. Thanks for listening, especially to those who took the time to call and to email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.